Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.
No, I'm not. I wouldn't forget to press the record button. That only ever happened once, in my defense. It only ever happened once. Hello, everyone. Today is another day, and in the idea that me and Drac might be interchangeable people, Drac is away this week, and I am back. It's Dr. Clark, and it's episode 55 of Bilge Pumps. Today we are joined by Jamie Seidel of Armored Carriers, and also by Cyclic. So if you're not sure who that is, if any of you have ever been on Drac's server or my server, then you will notice that the person most likely to be enforcing the rules when we are away, and actually who you probably want enforcing the rules because he's actually nicer than either of us, we're both quite sarcastic, is Cyclic. And that's also why he's keeping to his specific, you know, name for this episode, because frankly he has had to enforce the rules and he doesn't want anyone turning up at his house to go, "But you banned me!" Yes, because you couldn't produce a single document to back up what you were saying.
And he's here to enforce the rules on us.
To try. Yeah.
This is why we've invited him today, to raise the standard of bilge.
Yes, and as mentioned, Drac is at the Chalk Valley History Festival, currently armed with a longbow, a couple of swords, possibly an axe, and within range of Dan Snow. All those who would like to make bets, well, I'm sorry, by the time this comes out, the History Festival will be over, so you will know the answer to what happened.
There may be a news article published.
I don't know. So, the reason we asked Cyclic on, really, is because whenever we're talking about small carriers on our servers, he has one of the best informed and one of the best worked through and fought through takes. And this week we are starting off with a specific article. And this specific article is from SimSec, because they sent it through to us, because the author, Ben Didonto, wanted it to be read by the Bilge Pumps crew. And honestly, it was possible.
We couldn't have him on?
I tried to invite him and it didn't work. Basically, whereas our good friend Cyclic doesn't mind getting up at 6 a.m. in the morning to talk to us, Didonto seemed to. He might not. Don't know. I sent the email back and it didn't, and I got no response. So, you know.
That's fair enough. It's okay.
Life happens. It could have got lost in translation. It could have got who knows what's going on. So, and it's called Armed and Independent, Thinking Outside the Box on Small Carriers. So, I'm going to turn it first over, in the interest of balance, to Jamie to talk about this article. No. Because nicer to it than either me or Cyclic. And certainly nicer than Drac was.
Look, I just come from a different perspective, in that I respect people who challenge established norms.
I do too.
And in a way that, you know, brain that unsettles established thinking. And now, you know, the article presents an argument that's not new by any means. It just explores it in that the author's particular way. Mm-hmm. It's the author's, you know, explains each of his points, explains each of his arguments, and he, you know, quantifies and qualifies that, yep, he might be wrong because he's speculating, which immediately gets my respect. So he's not being strident in any way, shape or form. And I don't know, maybe it's because I'm a cynical old journalist, people that are strident immediately tend to get to raise the devil's advocate in me. And so therefore, by reading an article which was, openly, shall we say, humble about its own efforts to tackling a controversial subject, it just, you know, it won extra attention from me, shall we say.
Okay. So now shall we get into... I have to say, I do agree that he is honest about that, and that does get my respect. But... and you see, actually, I do agree with him on the idea of removing Strike from a carrier. I think if you want to make a... what he's basically is talking about, and if you really want to make a load of USN veterans start to shudder, he is talking about an area control ship. He is talking about an escort carrier.
That is pretty much his open and declared statement. And the reason given for it was the difficulty that modern warships have defending themselves from the air.
Yeah.
And you only have how many supercarriers?
Yes, and the other interesting thing, which I don't think he did mention in this article, but I would have liked to have seen, is the idea of how they could have operated together. Because if you could have one of these integrated into your carrier battle group, that could be a whole lot of things taken off the strike carrier. So he was talking about you needing super-sized strike carriers and super-large strike carriers, and I was thinking, well, actually, you don't. If you had one of these added into your battle group, you could give certain missions over to that vessel, and your carrier, your large carrier, could therefore concentrate on the strike role more.
That immediately makes me think, and feel free to jump in anytime you like, basically, because that's how we work here. Sitting around at the pub table, metaphorically, and tossing ideas to the wind. Look, the point is that with that sort of scenario, you get the worst of both worlds. You don't get the best. So I would say that, you know, no, a light fleet carrier or a escort carrier does not mean you get rid of your entire strike carrier force.
No.
It just means that your strike carrier force is freed up to be a strike carrier. It's not being demanded to be also an escort carrier or a area denial carrier. It allows the strike carrier to do its job properly and to do its job with focus, just like having supporting fleets of drones allows your F-35 strike fighter to be a strike fighter and not all the other secondary roles that place so much demand on its time, its airframe, its flying hours, its pilots. So... I think that is the trap that these proposals often fall into, is that people think that it's an either-or situation. Now, I guess that's the reflex response when people are thinking in terms of budgets and allocation of resources. Now, yeah, of course, it means that you probably can't afford 15 fleet carriers, but...
The Americans don't have 15 fleet carriers. Correct me if I'm wrong, Cichlic. It's about nine currently in operation?
We have 10 in operation and one going through shock trials. And of those 10, because that's just the Nimitz class, of those 10, one is presently actually just down the waterfront from me, going through midlife upgrade and refueling.
But I mean, that was from, and I'm just casting back off a vague memory here, that was the high tide mark of the supercarriers, wasn't it, around 15?
Yes. That said, a number of them were conventionally powered and about 20 to 30,000 tons lighter than the Nimitzes.
Right, okay. All right, so we'll say 12 has always sort of been the high tide mark, I suppose, for the fleet carriers. So, you know, I agree with criticism if people say that you replace your strike carrier force with escort carriers, because all you have to do is read about what happened at the likes of Salerno, the naval operation supporting the invasion of northern Italy. On paper, it looked like it would work. Five or six escort carriers, each carrying 20 aircraft or 15 aircraft, with a nice HMS Unicorn in the middle as its sort of support ship, and with its command and control facilities and the like, and a cruiser with the admiral on board running the show, sounded great. The only problem was is that it was dead calm, trying to get a Seafire to land on a deck in 12 knots of headwind isn't a pretty scenario. It's only slightly better to land a wildcat slash martlet in those conditions. But you didn't have the ideal ships for the job. The ideal ships for the job were there, formidable and illustrious, but they were being held, quote-unquote, as in reserve as, quote-unquote, distant cover, which I suppose is what, you know, you do with a fleet carrier. So, again, they were doing a job that they weren't optimized for. They called them assault carriers, but they were still escort carriers, basically.
Yeah, circling back around to what the author's talking about, the author, correct me if I'm wrong, but specifically mentions convoy escort. And that's why the author's like, it doesn't matter that they can't keep up with the carrier. Realistically, for that, there's an even better, more affordable base hull for this. And that is something like an Alaska class tanker, which the U.S. already uses for expeditionary advanced bases, Lewis V. Pullers. I think that's the. Mm-hmm. Expeditionary advanced bases is the Marine concept.
I think to be fair, we probably need to define what his argument was first before we start going for alternatives. So would either one of you like to detail it?
The way that I see it, the author looks at the primary role of this ship. Yeah, since convoy escort is the primary mission, and there is no need to keep up with supercarriers.
And by convoys, we're not just talking cargo ships. He's specifically talking about, well, not specifically, but he does highlight the need to protect the troop transports and the mm-hmm. amphibious ships and the like, and how that the America class and the likes are quite expensive for what they do, and therefore even they will be under pressure in terms of providing the cover that the ongoing logistics support network needs.
And the for this role, the lovely, there are aspects I disagree with, but for this role, using a merchant base hull as is, particularly if you do things like fill bulkheads in areas that you don't need, because quite frankly, the Alaskas are 50,000 ton vessels, but we have 3 or 4 yards here in the U.S. that aren't actively building, actual combatants that could build them. So I'm not worried about the production end side of that. They're relatively cheap. They are much bigger than you actually need, so you can do things like filling compartments with foam that you don't actually intend to use to help with reserve buoyancy, help avoid an Atlantic conveyor situation, things like that. So I would shy away from actually putting a lot of the self-defense systems on this, because again, that increases cost, that increases the amount of crew you need on it. The USN is very, very much looking like it is going to procure well beyond 20 guided missile frigates. And actually the acting SecNav just mentioned that they're going to be signing another multi-year contract on Flight 3 Berks yesterday.
So once again, I suppose it's pretty smart to mention here that the proposal in the essay is pretty much a derivative of the Russian, what's that class called?
Class.
What he's talking about is stripping the San Antonio hull down to its baseline and adding in the stuff you need for a flight deck and a ski ramp assisted flight deck. So he's gone British style on that. And the weapons and sensors from a Flight 3 Berk in order to sort of...
He's thinking of an all-in-one package, like the Kievs, and his argument being that, you won't need your frigates because you can then send... Or destroyers, because they can be off with the fleet carrier doing their job, looking after the fleet carrier, while you've got a all-in-one solution escort vessel here, which does, you know, it does ring that alarm bell of all the eggs in one basket. But then again, this isn't a frontline ship.
It's
a ship that has to deal with contingencies that surprise, you know, your convoy that shouldn't really be just charging into the teeth of a storm anyway.
However, if you have an amphibious task force that this is providing the main air support and close defense of, you have encountered a major problem. You now have a single point of failure. You're not carrying any airborne sensors outside of your F-35s, which what this author is proposing here. And you're entirely relying on one ship for your task force area air warfare, rather than, particularly with the U.S. Navy's cooperative engagement capability and Naval Integrated Fire Control Counter-Air, which links the entire task force together, utilizes all their
when
sensors.
The Wi-Fi is working. Only when the Wi-Fi is
Only when the Wi-Fi is working, definitely, yes.
Yeah, correct. However, one of the things that they are heavily looking at is line of sight data links. Those are very, very hard to disrupt. Just as basically a principle of any sort of line of sight communication. It's one of the major roles that they're looking at for the unmanned surface vessel medium, is being a node in that so that they can chain things out. And with that in mind, getting a frigate or two, or whatever you can on a radar picket roll, that will dramatically help increase your radar coverage if you don't have something like an E2. And it also has a secondary benefit of a lot of your advantageous radar picket positions for a task force, in a modern sense, also tend to be your advantageous ASW picket locations. And you are definitely going to want ASW escort. And you can get some of that from the littoral combat ships, at least the Independences, because let's not talk about the Freedom class, please. You can't get the combining gear spec'd right. But so when you, yes, I have seen that article.
I would say the reason this is starting to has caused a reaction in me, it has, is because honestly, what I thought he was redesigning, and our listeners, and if anyone hasn't, please go and look up the BAE Systems UXT, or sometimes as it's called, the BAE Systems Maritime PVT Surface Fleet UXV. And basically, if you could imagine a Type 45 Zumwalt Japanese hybrid carrier battleship combination being sort of mixed together, that is what you have got and brought, you know, that is what it looks like. And there are a few others like this going around. And so that is one of my things with this topic, is it's an idea on it, in that it's using the San Antonio hull. But I would say there's a lot of ideas going around alike it, especially the drone carrier one. And the drone carrier one, there's an article on the Naval News, which is it time for the U.S. Navy to introduce a drone carrier? And they've got various, the Ocean Avenger, etc., and all these things. And the point I keep coming back to is the short answer is yes, but the long answer is, but in what form? And that's the point with this one, because I think it's going for the F-35s and saying we use them as the airborne early warning. I would hate to use an F-35 as airborne early warning. You're actually, it's talking about using drones and having drones on board. That's fine. That's your airborne early warning. Have enough of them. The air group, and that was the big thing. I was going through the air group.
Yeah. That is the weak point of the proposal. It is the F-35, because A, is $100 million a piece, okay? And B, it doesn't get the scale it needs of an escort carrier to be effective. So you're wasting a premium asset on a first line asset on a second line vessel. So
what I would say is, and this is going to sound terrible, there have been has been time and time again in operational history, the same figure keeps coming up for how many fighters you need to maintain a cap over a convoy, over anything. Jamie will know that figure.
It's 18.
18. It's 18. It's always 18. It comes back. No matter how advanced we get with aircraft, it always comes back to 18. No one has yet really sort of figured this sort of out. I have a feeling
it's just pure usefulness. You need groups of four to five up in the air.
And you need logistics, and the aircraft aren't always going to be available. So you need an air group of 18. This has got 12, and that's the first point. If this is an escort carrier,
but even 18 F-35s is not a good use of an F-35. In my opinion.
Not probably for an escort carrier. It's got 12 helicopters, 12 MH-60s, and then it's only got two MQ-8Cs and one MV-22. Now, I would say for an aircraft, for a ship which is supposed to be an escort carrier, especially one which he wants to keep the well deck to support UVs and USVs and small boat operations if required.
He does put lots of
qualifying. And remember, this is on a 28,000 ton hull.
Yes.
And you want to add even more room for storage of aircraft, because the San Antonios don't have that outside of their one hangar for helicopters.
Deleted in this design.
Yes, in place of the flight deck. I'm not sure the San Antonios are the greatest base hull for it. It's an inspired idea. It's definitely an area to look at, but I think you really need to go and look at something larger. Now, as for, the F-35s thing, what I would recommend is if you're basically looking for a Stovall light carrier to be the centerpiece of an expeditionary strike group, which is inevitably what this would become, in how the U.S. Navy operates.
Especially if it's based on a San Antonio hull, it's going to end up part of being the U.S. That force being deployed.
What that does allow you to do is take the F-35s off of the LHDs and LHAs, transition them entirely to helicopter air wings for Marine rotary wing attack. So AH-1Zs, UH-1Ys, and then offload potentially some of the larger helicopters from the Ospreys and things like that to the LH A and D from other ships in the ARG, and that allows you to dedicate the strike group centerpiece to providing air cover, providing air support, and providing interdiction of maritime patrol assets, all those sorts of things.
It does give it focus, doesn't it?
Yes. Mm. Now, there is a piece I've been thinking about writing for a little while, that the working title I have right now is, if you're going to argue for a U.S. light carrier, argue for it right. The U.S. Navy, in its history, despite multiple analytical studies, despite multiple ideas, including from, at times, the chief of naval operations, has only ever adopted light carriers once in its history. Jamie, you may be very familiar with this.
I'm very aware of the debate. The 1930s was a very strident argument within the U.S. Navy between, the concept of redundancy through having lots of small carriers or mid-sized carriers, or the focus of the big carriers. Now, interestingly enough, before 1939, it was the middle-sized carrier fleet that was in ascendancy in terms of the politics of the U.S. Navy at the time. But the experience of the Royal Navy in the first few years of the war made them change their mind. And throw their backing behind the Essexes. So, yeah, it's that was a close run thing, really.
The one time the U.S. Navy did adopt the concept with the Independence class, there was a very, very specific reason, and it's a reason that I have yet to see in proceedings articles and SimSec articles ever mentioned, and it's simply down to, yes, the bigger carriers are more efficient. They are more bang for your buck for air power. However, they have a fixed build rate. If you need more carriers and you need them now, that's where you need to go with smaller, because you can build them at more yards.
You can convert your Cleveland and Baltimore hulls.
Yes. And, in the modern guise of the Independences, to be honest, if you're looking at getting number of flight decks out, now, an escort carrier thing, that's fine, and there may be a role for that, particularly, I would argue, more as an ASW asset.
This was going to be my very next point. We're actually not talking about two different things here. We're talking about three different things.
Yes.
Yeah. Because in the 1930s, the Royal Navy was having this discussion, and it decided to go with the contingency of escort carriers, converted merchant ships, mm-hmm. liners, and the like. And it prepared its contingencies for that. It decided that light fleet carriers are not necessarily the best way to go. And it decided that in case of emergency, we will slap a flight deck on top of our grain carriers, and we will convert ships like the Queen Elizabeth, which they didn't do in the end, but they prepared plans for it, into a medium-sized escort carrier. But they ended up being in exactly the same situation as the United States. They built light fleet carriers because they needed more combat-capable flight decks, but they didn't have enough of the right-sized shipyards, so they built the Colossus class to merchant spec on merchant shipyards.
And then they last for frickin' ever. They do. I have to say that the reason this debate is sort of interests me is because we go into it, and when we're talking about this, you have the recent comments by General Miley, the U.S. Army's, the U.S. The senior
chief of staff,
the chief of staff of the U.S. Forces, Armed Forces. A really, really smart guy. We have to agree. You might like him, you might not, but no one's going to call him dumb. Anyone who does is probably very dumb themselves. Leaving that to one side,
yeah,
he says he's
from the Northeast. That would be a really bad idea.
Yeah. he reckons China wants capability to take Taiwan by 2027, which means theoretically you have 6 years, and 2027 to 2035 is probably the high risk period. So then you've got 6 years, and you've probably got about 8 to 9 years of high risk. If you wanted to grow the American carrier fleet in that time, your only option is to build some conventional hulls, because there is only so much capacity, as we talked about in the infrastructure episode a couple of weeks ago. There is only so much capacity to build.
Yeah, you need to bring Pascagoula into the equation.
Which brings the argument down to, do you build a light fleet or do you build escort carriers?
I would personally say a light fleet. And the reason for that is, first and foremost, even if the war doesn't happen, even if they don't make the push for Taiwan, what a light fleet allows you to do is actually seriously scratch the CENTCOM itch, seriously scratch the NATO itch. Because quite frankly, a light fleet running a strike fighter contingent of F-35C, and then in the 2030s, as we start to see loyal wingmen and things like that potentially become viable, particularly on a carrier, you can bring those assets on as well. A light fleet is able to operate MQ-25s for refueling, for maritime patrol. There's a reason it's got an MQ rather than an RQ. And it most importantly, it allows you to bring the E-2 and whatever the E-2 replacement is. So And that's that last reason is why everybody wants, every U.S. combatant commander right now wants a carrier, because the U.S. Air Force's E3s have an absolutely atrocious readiness rate. There's a reason that the commander of Pacific Air Forces is begging from to everyone that will listen, I need E7s. It's the fastest way to get me workable AWACS. So, it allows you to bring that. You can move the F-35 buys you were already planning on doing to these light fleets. And then you can focus NGAD on the super carriers. That allows you to do two best of both worlds. The reason I say that is these light fleets are not going to be able to efficiently operate NGAD. NGAD is going to be a huge aircraft. There's no way around it. And that gives you a justification to the U.S. Navy's oldest standing enemy to keep the supercarriers. You have to justify this force structure to Congress. Fleet architecture is as much politics and industry as it is naval strategy.
And I mean, the other element to this is that the idea of escort carriers is obviously predicated on having available, workable, multi-role drones, which the US doesn't really have yet. I mean, you've got specific purpose ones, you know, the Global Hawk and the like, but, you know, the sort of loyal wingman-esque kind of drone, semi-autonomous / autonomous, is still a way off yet. And there's just no way you want to put an F-35, as valuable as they are, in penny packet sizes on merchant hulls, which are, you know, have had a flight deck strapped on, even if it has a hangar. So you don't have any middle ground in the air options available. And you don't even have, especially don't have the lower ground. You don't have that kind of smaller craft other than a helicopter. And you know, I mean, while I think that helicopters would be extremely useful as an escort asset, it's not as useful as it would have been during Cold War One, because the air threat and missile threat is now magnitudes greater than Cold War One. Cold War One, the main threat was submarines. Now it's submarines and cruise / ballistic missiles and long-range bombers. So you do need... To justify a escort carrier, you need it to be able to protect from the air as well. The equivalent of the Condor flying over, you know, and it's. I don't think you want to slap an F-35 on a MAC ship.
I mean, there is an argument for having six of them, so you can always have one or two, preferably two. Okay, so maybe eight, but have a small detachment of them so you can have them on alert, not necessarily standing cap, because the advantage that the F-35 does bring over something like a Harrier is they can kick the tires, light the fires, and get out somewhere quick.
Oh, yeah.
So you can potentially deal with some of the Chinese relatively high altitude, not all that nimble, not all that fast drones that you may not even want to let get within SM-6 range. It allows you to chase away other maritime patrol assets, things like that. But that's more their role. And barring that, say you have a fleet carrier screening you, you can then use those F-35Bs for putting ordnance where ground troops need it, depending on what you're doing. But realistically, the F-35B, for all it is, if you want to carry a meaningful air-to-air loadout and retain your stealth, right now you are looking at four in the F-35B AMRAAMs because it's bay size. That may change with things like Peregrine, which will, for every AMRAAM, allow you to carry two, roughly the same, from what I understand, roughly the same range performance as an AIM-120C. So that gives you a very capable BVR missile and twice the load. But again, okay, It's got 8 now. What does an F-35C have? 12. It's 50% more.
Is that internal?
Yeah, internal. Even if you go to that half-size missile, it's still 50% more. F-35C gets you better range, better speed to range because you got more fuel, more capability. It allows you to do strike if you need to a lot better. And it's all well and good to say, we don't need this thing to do strike. Well, what happens if, and Guadalcanal flashbacks here, an enemy surface action group gets discovered.
You've got a problem.
To deal with them.
Yeah, I mean, but again, it's it doesn't have to be its primary. I think there's a difference here.
It just needs to be.
It's not its primary role. It needs to be able to carry at least one load out of, you know, strike weapons on board somewhere so that you can get the ships to, can get the aircraft to do that mission if necessary. But as an escort, it's doing escort things, and you don't want to lose your escort because people say, oh, we've got a strike carrier here that should be doing strike instead of escort. And then all of a sudden you don't have an escorted formation. So this is the problem. And that's the same problem that the fleet carriers have. Fleet carriers have to do everything. There's only so many of them. And one big ship might dominate a particular radius of action, but it can only dominate one radius of action.
And that's the problem we're basically dealing with, is that we all know the larger ships are more effective. But we also know that one ship can only be in one place at a time. And that therefore its aircraft can only carry one area at a time. And we also know there's the limitations of single carrier operations. We all know from World War II, we all know from subsequent operations of World War II, we know from the exercises prior to World War II, that if you want to have a successful fleet operation, really, if you're using carriers, you want to be a multi-carrier operation. There is a reason the British, the Americans, the Japanese were experimenting and testing and practicing this way all through the 1930s. There is also a reason the British spent most of the beginning of World War II lamenting the fact that they were fighting everywhere in the world, because it meant they couldn't concentrate their forces and do what they properly wanted to do with them. And there is a reason why the Kido Batai were quite so powerful, because they concentrated everything in one blow to give the blow. And this is the point. The trouble is with the nuclear carriers, with the current carrier program, you can't get enough of them available. You just can't, because you can't have enough of them in the first place with commitments around the world. With the light fleet carriers concept, if you build some light fleet carriers, and let's say they are Queen Elizabeth sized, because that's roughly sort of the region you're probably looking at, conventionally powered, Qatar, they'd be very capable ships. But the thing is, the important thing is, they would be very versatile assets. If you wanted to use them as an escort carrier to support your amphibious task group, you could do quite happily, quite capably. If you wanted to form up a multi-carrier battle group and you only had two of the nuke carriers available, but oh look, there's this carrier which is currently not supporting an escort or not escorting an amphibious task group, it's being used maybe as a training carrier or a supporting carrier, right, and we'll take it out of that role for a short time and put it into this task group, we've suddenly got a third carrier, which helps, because that is a third load of fighters. That is a third load of AE-2s. That's a third load of anti-submarine helicopters. And perhaps that's what you do. You basically use it to escort the strike group. So the strike carriers, you can go, right, and we can take off your anti-submarine helicopters. We can take off certain things from you, because they're all on the strike, on the escort carrier, the light fleet carrier, which basically its job is to fight the battle to get you through, and then your job is to launch an overwhelming strike of large drones, of F-35s, of whatever you are loaded up with. It gives you options. And that is the thing. The US Navy at the moment, in 6 years, you could probably get one. Let's be honest.
Probably looking at the first two.
Yeah.
Out of, if you go with a Pascagoula propelled by four to six LM2500s.
So if we then go back to your Flight Deck Alaskas, which let's face it, can be carrying nothing but a few weather balloons
and helicopters.
They could be floating along with nothing but weather balloons when they don't need aircraft. And then when you need a flight deck, you've got a flight deck. And then you allocate to that flight deck what is needed for that role, that particular mission. Why does it have to have a permanent task group? Why does it need to? We can take a leaf out of the British book here. build the ship, but not the aircraft, and see what happens.
A tailored air group approach is what we call it. A tailored air group.
So, you know, what that means is that, you know, you've got that flight deck option. You've got it because, and that's what these lessons of the World War II and pre-World War II kept teaching us, was that when you get a kamikaze on your flight deck, when you get a bomb hole punch for your flight deck, when you get a pile up of aircraft in a flight deck crash, you can lose your entire air group if you don't have a spare flight deck or two.
And that's why I mentioned the Caddo Bar. Sort of, I would actually knock it down a step even from a QE, again, because of that, not have it being able to efficiently operate NGAD. But the ability to have cats and traps gives you the ability to go and be a divert field for whatever reason for the supercarrier. And yes, potentially by 2027, 2028, best case scenario, you're looking at two of these. Realistically, at that point, Pascagoula or whoever you have building these is going to have hit their stride. And one thing that we do know about U.S. shipyard, military shipbuilding, is when military shipbuilding in the U.S. hits its stride, it is able to rapidly produce things and efficiently produce things. So the Chinese raised the stink a little bit with commissioning three ships at once. The U.S. has traditionally been commissioning between 2 to 2.5 Arleigh Burkes a year. Then you need to add on every 6-7 years a supercarrier. You need to add on the Virginia class subs. You need to add on all these other ships. That doesn't really get looked at much, which kind of surprises me. But just in terms of a yard like Pascagoula, they are one of the most modern, large-scale military shipbuilding yards on the planet. The entire yard got redone in 2005, post-Katrina. They are currently expanding the facility they have on the east bank of the river there to allow them to more rapidly fit out ships, which is the main bottleneck they currently have. I mentioned Pascagoula because they already make ships in the 45,000 ton range with the Americas. The America hulls aren't ideal for this sort of a thing.
They're basically a big box.
But the U.S. does have studies from CVX, what led to the Fords, of a conventionally powered mid-sized fleet carrier, something in that 50,000 ton range that has two cats. The USN already has that design. It's sitting in an archive right now. I don't know if they did the hull testing, but it's going to dramatically speed up what you're able to do. So I can't stress enough just the ability to have a third platform with E2. Yes, right now the U.S. Navy's carrier, the concept moving forward for the carrier air wing, has 5 E2s per carrier. Now, you wouldn't be able to do that many because E2 is a huge platform on this. But even getting 2 or 3, it's a huge help. It means
Two or three is great for an escort group.
Yeah.
And it could be the difference in a combined force. So
yeah. And in a combined force, what it means is, I now have the opportunity to send an E2 out with the strike. I now have the opportunity to send more F-35s out with the strike. And in this prior to 2030 time period, that is the highest risk, right? If if not just if you ask me, but if you ask the head of Indo-PACCOM, if you ask General Miley, if actually probably if you ask all of the Joint Chiefs, this from now till 2030 is a very high risk time period for conventional deterrence between the US and the PRC. So getting the ability to have a carrier in that interim that is still going to be able to operate F-18 Super Hornet Block 3 and F-35C just fine is very, 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 very potentially useful. Yes, they're nowhere near as good as the supercarriers. However, you're not disrupting supercarrier production. You're expanding your production of EMALS, AAG. You're likely going to use the advanced weapon elevators as well, which are finally coming into stride. Ford, I think, if you ran the math based on what's available for these elevators, Ford was able to, with half of her elevators installed, beat out a Nimitz in ordnance to flight deck and hangar. So there's all sorts of things like that. And again, that number is based off publicly available information. I don't know if that is what's going on behind the scenes. Certainly now, with only two elevators left to go, she's able to do it. She's already, I think the captain mentioned in an interview with the press on board while she was doing some workups prior to the shock testing, that she's outpacing what a Nimitz can do in flight ops by miles. So between these, you know, the first two of this notional possible light fleet, and by 2027, you're looking at, I think, Enterprise being a year old in the fleet. And it's looking, based off JFK running ahead of schedule, it's looking like Enterprise is also probably going to run ahead of schedule. JFK may wind up delivering a little bit later than that schedule because Congress finally approved building her or doing a single delivery rather than a dual phase. That way the Navy can get her with the facilities needed for F-35 from the get-go. Thank you, Congress, for getting rid of that price cap limitation that led to that. But that's sort of the state, and you get JFK, potentially Enterprise, and then these two. That's a huge boon, particularly if you turn around and get lucky that, oh, Nimitz and the next ship to be replaced, oh, they still have reactor life left. If you get lucky there. Now, that's getting lucky. Because obviously you don't want to take a Nimitz back into an RCOH. Newport News Shipbuilding doesn't have that room. For one, mm-hmm. And even then, why are you spending basically half again the money for a platform that's as structurally old as that? But if you have the room in the reactor and you're faced with a wartime scenario, you're going to use it.
Yep.
So there's a lot of potential there, but I think the biggest benefit of a light fleet, because let's be honest, one of these light fleet carriers, if they're leading a NATO task group in the Atlantic, the Russians are hard pressed. Forget a supercarrier. You might still want to keep two of them in Atlantic fleet, but if you then are aiming for a force structure where you have four of these in Atlantic fleet, four of these light fleets, plus two supers, still keeping six carriers here in Norfolk, you now have carriers that you can keep out and operational because you have those four light fleets, three to support, one deployed. And then you have two CVNs that you can keep ready to surge either for a big NATO naval exercise or somebody gets a little too uppity in the Eastern Mediterranean, Turkey, or somebody gets a little too uppity in the North Atlantic. Hi, Russia.
I thought you were going to say really UK. You know, we could get up a tier if you want to.
Well, that's where we just detail Atlantic Fleet Swiss, and you only have six astutes, so you know.
Yes, but we also have me and Drakenafel, so you know.
Well, that's a problem for the Marines. That's a problem for the Marines.
And look, yeah, and that all makes perfect sense. And it's, you know, it's. The light fleets give you that flexibility, a cost effectiveness and flexibility. So, you know, there's just so many theaters where you don't need the biggest and the best and the most expensive and the shiniest.
No.
Where there are so many places where good enough is good enough. And and in a situation where good enough isn't enough, you bring them together. And then you're going to have more than good enough. So, we just seem to have a very eclectic mix of ship designs already in operation. By that I mean what are the Japanese, honestly, on the destroyer carrying F-35Bs, what are they there to do?
They're escort carriers, let's be honest. That is what they are.
That's what I mean. That's the only role that they could perform is limited cap with anti-submarine helicopter support.
Yeah, that's exactly what they intended with them too.
So that is basically this proposal here document, this essay.
What the South Koreans are building.
And South Koreans are building that. And, Malaysia got its carrier, which I don't think it has any aircraft operational anymore. What was that? That the only effective role, other than a gunboat diplomacy, would be escort. The Spanish have got their Harrier carriers, which might carry F-35Bs. They are, I suppose they're choke point control, aren't they, for the Mediterranean entrance and, convoy escort. So I think the convoy escort role is there. It's needed. I just don't think the F-35s, whether they are B or C, because this is the other choke point in this whole concept here, is where do you get the aircraft from? Now, F-35s are not cheap. They're not easy to build. So this is why I was saying earlier, you don't want to waste them in penny packets of 8 to 12 scattered around the ocean. You need to put them together in a force where they will be, where all of their advantages will stack up. The thing is that you need something else to fill in the good enough role, the light fleet carrier role of aircraft, to be on these ships as a backup force. The United States Air Force has had so much hassle for so many years trying to come up with, a counterinsurgency aircraft. Well, okay, it's counterinsurgency aircraft is no good as a peer-on-peer conflict, unless it's supporting roles. But what do you need a F-35B or C when you've got your distant cover supercarrier anyway? What you need is something that will give you flexibility for filling in a hole, pushing up as a missile truck when you need it. But it's certainly not going to be the aircraft you will rely on to break into an area denial zone. So, Harrier obviously has so many weaknesses and faults, but there's got to be something to fill that gap, whether it's a drone, whether it's a manned aircraft. If you're going to go for an escort carrier, people like the Japanese and South Koreans would probably be better off looking at something else.
Well, I mean, fundamentally, one of the things that drove this, for lack of a better term, resurgence or renaissance in Stovall carriers was the fact that you could get out of an F-35B, quite frankly, a capability that is remarkable for the size of ship that you can operate it off of. And for somebody like the Japanese, the Izumos were specifically originally designed to be converted and are now being converted for a very, very specific role. And that is supporting a Japanese retake of the Senkakus. And in that guise, they do need that. They do need the capability of an F-35B. The South Koreans are looking at their carriers sort of a dual role, both for, they're not going to say this, but for pushing back against the Chinese naval buildup to an extent, for getting carrier experience should they want to go bigger later on, and then also for being able to push into North Korean airspace in the event of a conflict there and act as an off-axis, good luck rocket artillerying this with a mix of HE and chemical.
Because I'm 100 nautical miles offshore. And in that regard as well, having F-35B makes that insanely easy. Whereas if you go in with, say, for lack of a better term, I know it never really got fielded and it's dead at this point, but a Western equivalent of Yak-141, you know, trimming out the stealth, you're trimming out the really advanced avionics. Yeah, you still have the supersonic capability, but penetrating into North Korean airspace becomes severely problematic without the ability to put up and sustain a dedicated strike package that's capable of doing jamming, suppression of enemy air defense, doing its own cap, and then still maintaining a strike force. So having something like F-35B allows you to be able to dramatically reduce that if you want to be able to do strike, if you want to be able to compete on par with something like J-20. If you want to have a hope of competing with J-20, if you're the Japanese, you do need F-35B on these ships. You're not competing that against an asset like J-20 with something cheaper. And the Japanese really, really, really want to be able to put reliable air cover that's able to operate and get to the theater on very short notice, because it's in, you know, deployed right there as part of the task group, air cover for a potential retake, i.e. amphibious landing of troops on the Senkakus. Because you never want to do an amphibious landing without air cover. You know, we were mentioning, what was it, Salerno earlier, right?
Yes.
It's really bad territory to be in if you're trying to do an amphibious landing without air cover. Heck, the Falklands cut it close. If you look at San Carlos water, they cut it real close. The Royal Navy got it done. Credit to them for sticking it in. But it's uncomfortable.
The concept of an F-35B light, you know, it does have a certain enticement to it in the sense that, okay, you get the aircraft now, even if you don't get all the capabilities, for, you know, a reasonable cost. But do you really? I mean, I suppose you'd have to build another production line, which you might as well turn into just a straight-out F-35B full. So either which way, you've still got to build another production. And as you say, it becomes a scenario where, yes, you've got your escort carrier floating around with swordfish and wildcats aboard in 1945. It's fine for behind the lines and anywhere down threat, as soon as you start getting into an area that's a little bit risky, well, all of a sudden that swordfish isn't going to cut it, and nor is that wildcat.
Yeah, all of a sudden you might as well be a green Japanese aviator, even in a very good plane, up against the creme de la creme of the U.S. Navy at Philippine Sea, and you don't have a hope. Particularly if you're operating, realistically, the Philippine Sea is about as far, from what I can tell of what's available, as the USN is really looking at pushing even a carrier task force. Anything that goes beyond that is almost certainly just going to be surface ships and subs. And by surface ships, surface combatants, so surface action groups, things like that. Things that have a very, very high density capability to absorb attacks, but need support to cover them. So if you're operating in the Philippine Sea, you can
effectively... Which does bring us back to the proposal, doesn't it?
Well, again, the
modern Kiev.
Yes. However, if you have the carrier strike force, so two fleet carriers operating in the Philippine Sea at a range where, if they want to, They can still range out into the East China Sea or into the South China Sea because of the range of their aircraft. The East China Sea, I think, at its greatest extent, is 600-700 miles in width, east-west. Or not east-west, it'd be at this point, but sort of southeast or southwest to northeast. But realistically, that thickest part is covered by air power out of Japan. Which is operating from largely hardened airfields now with, I mean, the Japanese Air Force controls their Patriot batteries. I think that tells you where those Patriot batteries are going to be. which is good because it makes the airfields very, it dramatically affects your shot calculus for ballistic or cruise missiles, because now you have to devote more missiles per target, and because you've got hardened shelters, you can't just go, oh, run down the ramp with submunitions. It's now, at minimum, you need one good solid hit per shelter to deal with. So you've got that on that side. It's capable of being suppressed, but at effort, which means more of the Strategic Rocket Forces tells are focused there and off your
carriers. Let's be honest, no one's supplies are infinite.
Yep.
And we have talked about this before. Yes, the Chinese do have a lot of supplies, and yes, they can come back and fire again, and can come back and fire again. But if they're losing forces every time they fire and reveal their positions, and if they're using munitions every time they fire and reveal their positions, and the trouble is their own sensor network, they won't be firing in a vacuum. You'll be firing back at them. You'll be trying to degrade their sensor network as they're trying to degrade yours. So eventually you probably end up with a rather slightly high-tech version of World War One, where both sides are using tiny little periscopes to view into no man's land in the middle to get a very small view, because that just about survives. And they're looking out there to try and see what's going on.
And their artillery shells are rationed.
Yeah. As devastating as they are, they're rationed. Okay, this gets us...
I was going to say, one area that we could potentially explore here is your wonderful Falklands veterans friends, who might be able to tell us of the days when they did exercises with the likes of HMS Melbourne, HMAS Melbourne. Sorry, just offended all of the Australians here.
Yeah.
Including myself. You know, I've often wondered just how useful and how practical was a carrier like the old Majestic, with its handful of Skyhawks and a couple of Hellos. You know, they might be able to tell us that of the practicality of having that sort of
thing. I don't like to quote him without him being here, but I know from having just had similar discussions on this round with Michael Clapp before, who of course was before Commodore AEW, was a Buccaneer Squadron CO as an observer. And gone up through that way, and had also been involved.
How did that man take off? Buck pilots have some serious, you know what?
look, if you want to be really brave, Michael Clapp is a very tall man. Okay, he's well over 6 foot, especially when he's younger. He fitted in a Sea Vixen's observer cockpit. Now, if you've ever seen a Sea Vixen, there's a bubble on one side for the pilot. The observer has a hatch. The man was doing origami long before it was famous, is all I can say. Anyway, he liked operating with that, because what they did was they allocated roles. So the Melbourne would take on the role of day cap. Which would allow the Vixens to be concentrated on Nightcap and the aircraft on the British carrier to be used for strike. You know, that is how you work. Multi-carrier operations, every single flight deck helps. Yep. As long as it can keep up with the task group.
And be able to perform what it needs to actually do in the task group.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, gets us onto China, as we have managed to get there. And then that brings us to a very interesting little thing, which is, of course,
the new Chinese submarine, the new SSK, which some people have only just realized exists, according to this 25th of June, lovely sort of 2021 article in Naval News by H.I. Sutton. A few of us have been looking at it for a while. Some of us, the first view was apparently in May, but I seem to remember something being talked about this in March, but that might just be me putting things together. Joys of dyslexia, it happens to us. So, well, actually, joys of being human, let's be honest, not even dyslexia. This is the Yuan-class submarine, the new one. It looks... ostensibly, people keep going, have they been cracking the Swedish influence? Have they been managing to do to the Swedish what they did to the F-35 program? Because it does look like the A-26 class. Now, I would say, if I was going to copy any SSK at the moment, if I was the Chinese, it probably would be the A-26. And again, this is another option for, why are the Australians not talking to the Swedes? Why, Jamie? Why are they continuing with the French...
I think it's because several billion dollars are already committed.
I would say on the capability side, realistically, for what Australia wants to do with the range, and particularly the underwater range, they need something the size of a nuke that isn't a nuke because political reasons. I think the Australian Navy has gone, we would really want an SSN. But that's not a hill to kill the Navy on.
Yes.
Am I correct there, Jamie?
Look, I understand the argument completely. But you've got to remember that we just, and I say this every time, we don't have a nuclear industry. So for us to get the engineers to run a nuclear submarine fleet would mean we would have to steal yours. And I don't think you're going to let that happen. Yeah.
And when we say steal, we do actually mean there would be kangaroos turning up and kidnapping people in their pouches.
Emus, they're much more vicious.
Either that or they'll just go, we can offer you a lot more money, which tends to work with nuclear engineers. They know they can write their paycheck when they get out.
And Australia doesn't have the sort of deep wallets that even the United States now has. So, no, we couldn't do that. And, you know, let's face it, if we stole Britain's nuclear engineers and your nuclear engineers and India's nuclear engineers, all of a sudden, you know, we wouldn't have many allies left.
No.
Because that's what we have to steal for us to run.
No, they have a surprising nuclear industry.
Because, you know, we're talking 12 subs here. So, yeah it's eminently desirable but impossible to do nuclear. Yeah. And that, unfortunately, doesn't change geography. The geography of Australia is that we need nuclear equivalent range and capabilities. And that's what gets us into trouble. It's as simple as that.
Yeah. And
what I find interesting is, adjusted for age, honestly, the upholder class, which were 2,500 tons roughly. Then you've got the Collins class, which are about 3,000 tons. Well, roughly 3,000 tons. And now they're looking at the attack class, which are roughly 4,500 tons surfaced. So honestly, again, the more I go into it, the more I'm annoyed that the British haven't kept an SSK program going. Because honestly, I think the three nations which have the need for such a large SSK program are Britain, Australia, and Canada. And if we kept a program going, you could imagine Australia, Canada, and would have worked in with us, and we would probably all be building them ourselves, but doing the design and development work as a group, and it would make sense. And the whole reason the British went for the all SSN fleet was because we were supposed to get the money to maintain the numbers, and it was going to be more simple to maintain an all SSN fleet. And now look at us, we're down to six SSNs. And it's a case of, we know we don't have enough subs. We know we really probably need to get back into the SSK business.
we're getting into the XL UUV business because we don't want to admit we're getting back into the SSK business. But let's be honest, what is an XL UUV but a SSK without crew aboard?
That's what the US Navy's doing as well.
Yes,
and to be honest, I think that's
the Navy. That's what we don't want to admit. We don't need nuclear, and don't need Navy, which doesn't want to admit it needs something other than nuclear submarines. Does it gets into the extra large unmanned, extra large uncrewed undersea vehicle business?
And I think Australia has put some money aside in its recent defence budget for looking into those things as well. So I think you know, by the time we start, by the time we get our 12 attack class, they'll be well and truly obsolete, and we'll be wishing that we'd spent that money on, you know, whatever the son of Orca is.
Yeah. Now,
but let's get back to the Chinese one, because the new Chinese sub does look quite cool.
It does. Now, looking at it from what its sensor fit appears to be, it seems to have nearly the same, at least, arrangement of sonar windows and flank arrays as the traditional Yuan. It's the same length. A lot of that indicates that a lot of the internals haven't changed massively. Like, there's no new compartment because it's the same length, things like that. This is just going off of what H.I. Sutton has said, and I think in his past two or three articles about it. So it seems
is someone to follow, by the way. If you do want to have good knowledge on what the Chinese submarine program are, he does seem to usually have good stuff.
Yeah. Stick with him for subs. That's his lane. He can get out of it, and then it. But
I was getting into that when I was being nice. For subs, he's very good.
Well, I like to do like source evaluation, right? It's a very important skill, and I'm not dissing H.I. Sutton at that. Everybody's got their lane, and you need to stay, you know, within that lane. I'm being very careful to stay within my knowledge of subs here.
It's like I was being very careful last night when I was doing a live about the French Navy to keep as far apart from French politics as possible, because French government politics is definitely not my historical lane. So I was just going, look, it's just, I was just talking about turnover of the senior people, rather than getting into the whole internecine warfare of it, because French politics is passionate, let's say.
Yeah, well, let's go with that.
Okay, so back to the sub. What's with the weird sail?
The sail, to be honest, I think the China, because you talk to a naval architect, particularly one that's got experience with subs, and you show them this and you ask them why they have that, they're going to give you a reason. Because hydrodynamics, well-studied science, it's not as well understood as we would like because computing power isn't quite there yet. This is actually something I ran into during the first part of my degree in geology. We can't even model rivers all that well. We can model them, but not all that well. If you're talking about an interaction of a hull with water and how eddies interact with eddies, and just continue that.
And it doesn't scale that well either. So
no,
you do it with a model. You do it with a model, and you're only going to get a rough idea.
Yeah.
And you change that model by, you know, a few percent, and then all of a sudden you get a different water flow dynamic. So
and heaven
trust me,
in
the office next door to mine, where I'm currently sitting, is one of the world's foremost experts on coastal erosion and coastal flooding, and the various things that can happen when you end up with issues going on with your substrates. And she would tell you that there are more problems with the computer models than anything. Yeah.
There's a lot of
every time someone produces a computer model which tells you how the world's going to flood if the ice caps melt and all that stuff, she starts giggling, because in the nicest way, yes, oh well, that's a lovely idea, but basically what you've done is water levels rise by this much. The trouble is, it doesn't work quite like that when you do it in reality.
Water weighs a lot, so it also pushes the pushes on the surfaces it engages with. So that changes things as well.
As it warms, it expands.
Yes.
Yes.
That changes things. But getting back to the sub, what I suspect the Chinese have done, given how similar the hull is to its class,
what I suspect they have done is they have wanted, particularly with the modeling issue of, this is what we think this sale has done. The Swedes are well respected. Let's try it and see if it did what we think it does, and if we think it's useful to use. So you see this a lot with the Chinese.
It's less an example of, oh, they hacked into the computer files, and more a matter of, oh, that's a very appealing super firing arrangement. You've put your guns on Dreadnought. Why don't we try the same?
Yes.
And to be fair, the British did the same with the Italians more often than we'd like to admit during the various Dreadnought procurement period.
Yeah. And this is something very common in naval architecture, particularly when you're trying to establish a robust program, right? The Japanese worked directly with the British to do this. The Chinese kind of sort of did with different powers. There was a period where, you know, they learned how to make naval gas turbines because, well, GE was teaching them. They still have some ships in their fleet that are powered by LM2500s of a very similar age to what powers the Berks. Because in that period, the Chinese were near enough allies against the Soviets. So, you know, there's a lot of legacies. The Pakistani fighter, the JF-17, traces its history to a joint U.S.-Chinese program. There's all sorts of things like this, and I would hesitate, generally speaking, to straight up accuse an economy outright of, oh, you just copy, particularly when it's one as sophisticated as the Chinese. And in high tech issues, they're a major major naval shipbuilding economy, both on the civilian side and on the military side. I mean, as on the military side, it's evidence is in their fleet buildup, right? So, you know, they're smart, they're competent people. FC-31 definitely looks like a compromise of the F-35, but at the same time, there's only so many ways you're going to build sort of a light multi-role stealth fighter, right? If you're trying to keep costs down,
there's only so many ways you're going to build a radial engined monoplane in the late 1930s. No, the Zero, it wasn't a copy of a Brewster Buffalo or whatever it was supposed to be a copy of.
There were so many different claims of what it was a copy of, and I think that's pretty telling as to it's not.
Yes.
That's one of the more embarrassing periods of history.
But again, it's just evidence that, you know, the Chinese are willing to try these things out and are aware of what's going on.
As we've been talking about past, the Chinese construction is in very ways is often iterative rather than evolutionary. I.e., there's not a big, we're going to stop building or we're going to go away, design a whole new class, and then a whole new class is going to come in, boom. They like to make changes as they go. It's in many ways far more cost effective for the Chinese because they are building lots of them. And if it's terrible, then all they do is
replace the sail.
Get rid of it.
Or put a captain they want to get rid of in charge of it.
Both those options are perfectly fine. They work.
They did this with some of their older ships to force people to retire. It's a fascinating way of reforming your officer corps. Some navies should pay attention.
Keep some terrible ships in service and just go, right then, you're getting made captain of that. I suddenly feel the need to go and spend time with my family.
Or you can just paint them pink.
The Royal Navy tried that. That didn't work.
Do we want to talk about the little dust-up, by the way, that in the Black Sea?
Oh, we should probably talk about that, because if we don't, people will be asking us.
Storm in a teacup.
It's the one of the most contrived incidents I have ever seen. The Russians were actually firing behind HMS Defender as she goes,
and from outside effect, from outside the physical range, even at optimized range for elevation. It's
at which point it's sort of a case of, it's almost, I almost do wish Defender had responded by just swiveling her 4.5 around and just going, hello, would you like a warning shot from, would you like us to give you and do a warning shot for you? We'll fire in front of us with the 4.5, and that'll be the warning shot done for you. Would you like us to do that?
It's even more contrived than that.
Yeah.
It was about a week, possibly more ago, that Russia declared that it was going to have a live fire exercise in that patch of water.
Yeah.
So those 20 or so SU-24s, whatever they were, and some SU-30s, I think, were already going to be going there and dropping dummy bombs.
Yeah.
And they did. And they were nowhere in sight of the Defender, because the Defender wasn't in the war zone area, the exercise area, but the aircraft were operating in that area. So it was an opportunity for the Russians to say, oh, look, we're dropping bombs near the Defender, because they were having a pre-scheduled live fire exercise or dummy run exercise there anyway. And of course, you know, contriving to have your ship zipping past at 30 knots at the time that that's happening is a great way to get media attention.
And already in a patch of ocean, the Russians had closed during that time of heightened tension with Ukraine when they were doing that force build.
Yes, but it's the international passageway, so Britain was making sure it was using the international passageway to show it could, because the Russians keep trying to restrict passage between Ukraine and Georgia. Britain and technically Georgia is a NATO member, if I remember correctly.
No, they're not.
They are friends of NATO.
They are a partner, just like Ukraine.
It's one of those weird scenarios where they are, in some respects, treated as if they're almost a member of NATO. In some respects, they are not. Definitely not.
A 6 month long war game, basically, isn't it? That's what they're saying. Is that they've dedicated these no go zones for, you know, war game purposes. But these war game purposes are lasting for 6 months. And one of those is also includes the entrance to the Sea of Azov. So, yeah, it's that in itself is a bit of a, shall we say,
a stretch
of the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. So, yeah, and, you know, the right of innocent passage for a warship. Well, you know, again, that says you're not supposed to use innocent passage as a means of testing someone's ownership of territory. But of course, Britain says, but we don't recognize that they own that territory, so how can we test it? So, you know, this is what's now being called lawfare, and it is the epitome of modern gunboat diplomacy.
I mean, we did it to the Soviets in the same area during the Cold War. There's a couple of instances.
I think Arleigh Burke did it to the Russians in there not that long ago.
Yes. But I mean, I'm going back, you know, to the 70s and 80s. There's a really funny video of, I think, a Krivak. Actually, there's of something smaller than a Krivak, but there's another one of a Krivak. But ramming, I think it was Kalpens, a Ticonderoga. I think the Kalpens one wasn't a Krivak, but it was a small little, I want to say, KGB Border Guards ASW/patrol vessel. They called it a frigate. I know.
Call it the Corvette, and we'll call it.
Yeah. And the thing nearly capsizes. Just trying to scrape paint. And you look on the officers' faces. They're like, oh no.
So, look, I think the other thing that's, you know, that happened with Defender is that, you know, it's zipping through these waterways at 30 knots, apparently.
According to the Russians, it was doing 40-something knots. Defender would love to be doing 40-something knots.
It was only a Coast Guard vessel, so I imagine that doesn't get up to that sort of speed.
No.
And they were probably on the phone to Moscow saying, do we have permission? Do we have permission to fire the warning shots? Hello, hello? Can we fire the warning shots? And by the time they get...
finally giving the order.
By the time... they've gone. So that's why they were firing into the air so far behind, because it took that long to get through the chain of command. So
Interestingly enough, the Russians have actually produced the video of it happening, and you can actually listen, if you are familiar with British accents, you can listen to the British officer responding and basically going, what are you doing? But not saying that, being very, very, very polite, but basically saying, what are you doing here?
Other than making a fool out of yourself with this AK-630.
It was a nice little display of water.
Yeah. Look, I mean, yeah. The whole point is that Crimea, Ukraine, is a dangerous mess. It's been that way since 2014, and it's not going away anytime soon. And
It'll probably be that way till 2034, unless something really bad happens.
Well, that was my point. It's going to get to a point where, somewhere along the line, the quote-unquote global Britain will probably have to decide which fight it's going to choose. And, will it be Black Sea, Ukraine, or will it be South China Sea, Indian Ocean? Because, I think that's what Putin's doing here. He's maintaining the pressure, knowing that no one can actually fight a two-front war anymore.
Well, I think the thing is with the Ukraine issue and Crimea is that you can sort of fight a two-front war, in that you can, the central powers, as I like to call them, i.e. the ones who are either Mediterranean-focused or who have large land armies in Europe, can in many ways, and have the technology and capabilities that if they chose to back up Ukraine, they could roll the Russians back.
Barring they could do the big red button and territorial integrity use case for the Russians, but
barring the Russians going nuclear, they could roll back. And as I include France in that, broadly speaking, nations, if they chose to get involved, Russia's got to think, well, we can
mutually
use our
assured,
it's mutually assured, it's online. Whereas there are far fewer powers in terms of Western powers who can contribute significantly to security in the South China Sea. And pretty much as the French might get a nuclear carrier, I'm sure they will do it. I'm sure it'll be lovely, but it'll be one carrier. So
20 to 36 aircraft.
It will turn up at some point.
But it'll be a light fleet carrier, and it will fill that role with its NATO contributions.
Yes.
I'm starting to think that given the expense and complexity of these things, that might be the direction that the Western powers will have to trend towards, is starting to contribute capabilities as opposed to a whole force.
Yeah.
So.
And the thing is, the capabilities the British can contribute, as I said the other night, I do love the British Army. I have a great deal of respect for them. I have worked with them on many different things over the years. I love working with them. They are wonderful people. But their armoured programme has been mucked up something asunder. And it's been mucked up on the altar of, we all must buy anything other than BAE. Because honestly, the CV90 was the program ready and waiting to go, and we went and decided to develop Ajax.
But it's not British developed.
Who cares? The Ajax isn't British developed. It's terrible. Just grow up. And it's owned by BAE, so they could have built a factory in the UK, and it would have been fine. Honestly, if you want a factory built in Wales, get BAE to build the factory and start churning them out. I don't. It's not something I really care about on that front. What I care about is getting a decent vehicle into the art. And the fact is, we could have had a vehicle ready to go. It could have been in service. It could have stood in for Warrior. It could have done the Ajax rolls and all the other things, and we could be perfectly fine right now for the next 20 years.
Just we're start not breeding. Start breeding donkeys. Okay.
It also wouldn't be Don't the size joke. Of a barn and shake itself apart.
Yes.
As yes, a reconnaissance vehicle.
But this basically means, right then, so what are Britain's strengths? Well, it's going to be its maritime power and its air power. Its air power can contribute to both.
It's always been conflict. That way.
It has, yes, it's always been. Where's the maritime power most useful for? Well, our submarines can probably make the Russian Navy look like piñatas if they try and come any out of their northern bastions. And our aircraft carriers and our battle groups can probably go off and help in South China Sea far better than anyone else can from Europe.
Yeah. Anyway.
Or at least be the core of any European group which goes off to the South China Sea.
But the Russians will have their carrier back, and you'll need to keep the home fleet as a fleeting being.
Oh, good Lord. I was hoping we'd managed to avoid this. I got to 90 minutes.
Well, just look at how much of the Royal Navy a single German battleship tied up when it was parked in a fjord for how many years?
We managed to get to 90 minutes.
That's only because Bomber Command couldn't do their job.
So, if Kuznetsov is there,
90 minutes.
If Kuznetsov is there,
I can't say my fleet, name for it on the air.
that the home fleet will be absolutely and fully reinforced.
Look, if the Kuznetsov manages to float by the point at which we're talking operations, possibly in 2027 or further on, and is able to viably float somewhere at that point, then I'm sure the Royal Navy will happily send out the tugboat to assist it.
Yeah, in terms of Russian ships on course to join / rejoin their fleet, I'd be far more worried about Admiral Nakhimov.
Yes.
That is a ship capable of carrying 80... hypersonic anti-ship cruise missiles.
Although
is a hugely stressing threat to the entirety of the Royal Navy surface fleet, even if you concentrated it all together.
Yeah, those are the threats, which is why we also have these things called astutes. And yes, we might only have 6 of them. And yes, we do need some freaking SSKs probably to start acting as force enablers. Or we can, you know, what we could do at that point, honestly, those are worth it. We could load up an XL UUV with high explosives, just pack it full of everything and just send it off on a one-way mission.
I think we've done the episode for today. Now that we're starting to head off on these flights of fancy, I think it's a warning sign.
You had to bring up the Kuznetsov. We've got 19 minutes.
How could I resist teasing you about the Tirpitz?
It's also a fun way to tease the Russian Navy with their dumpster fire of a carrier. It's literally caught on fire repeatedly.
Look, we shouldn't be cruel, but there is a point at which you just go, come on, just be kind to it, let it go.
It's a ship that's tried to retire itself multiple times. Russian Navy have some sympathy.
Okay. All right. Well,
if anyone needs a light fleet carrier, it's the Russian Navy.
They've got one.
No, they've got something which floats and they call it a carrier. I'm not sure I'd call it a light fleet carrier.
Yes. Liaoning, Shandong, sure. Kuznetsov.
Be kind.
Russia, I know you don't have the capability to build a replacement yet. You've got to build that capability. And the first step in that is LHD. The LHDs you're building that are looking conspicuously like a modern Kiev with the VLS they're sticking in them for strike. But hurry up. Kuznetsov can't wait forever.
It really can't. At some point, it will have a problem somewhere where you cannot recover it from.
Which is a warning for, you know, keeping any ship in the system for too long, such as Ticonderogas and older Nimitzes.
Oh, yeah.
You have to remember.
Let the Navy retire the Tychos at the speed the Navy wants to. They're not worth the dock space they're eating, to be honest. The new frigates will have a better radar.
Quite possibly, but the Kuznetsov, let's be honest, when it's actually going down the channel, the British and the French not only have warships following it and aircraft, but they have environmental impact vessels following it, i.e. ships which are designed to clear up if the thing sinks. Because they are that sure that if it sinks in the air, in the channel, literally, we put cranes on alert, floating cranes on alert, every time that thing is in the channel, because we're so worried about it sinking in the channel.
And might blocking be a good use shipping for it. Lane.
Yeah.
It depends how shallow the channel is.
Yes! New island has appeared in the middle of the English Channel. Oh,
and it's
great.
Russian territory. It's Russian territory, too.
It won't be Russian territory for long. The English Channel will see to that.
All right. Seriously, end this.
All right. Take care, everyone. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you, Cyclic. Thank you, Jamie.
Thanks for having us.
Yep. Thank you, everyone.
Bye.
And stop in recording.
Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.